Right. Well, welcome everybody to our webinar, the BIPS webinar for April of 2022. I am absolutely delighted to be the MC, as it were, for the talk today on the City of Isfahan as Actor, Urban Knowledge and Household Anthologies, which is Professor Catherine Babalyan's latest book. Catherine is professor of Middle Eastern Studies and History at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. She is the author just of books, okay, of Mystics, Monarchs and Messiah, Cultural Landscapes of Early Modern Iran, 2002, which earned her an honorable mention for the Saidi Sirjani Book Award in 2004. She has co-authored Slaves of the Shah, New Elites of Safavid Iran with Susan Babai, Aina Baghdadnias McCabe, and also Masumeya Farhad, IB Taurus 2004, and has co-edited two books, Islamicate Sexualities, Translations Across Temporal Geographies of Desire with Afsaneh Najmabadi, 2008, and an Armenian Mediterranean Words and Worlds in Motion with Michael Pfeiffer out of Palgrave Macmillan 2018. And this present book is out of Stanford University Press and was published last year. I have a bit of a license to embellish on this. I've known Catherine for an awfully long time, and I would say this is the third of her seminal works. One which I count is her PhD dissertation, which I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, is 1993 under the late Martin Dixon at Princeton University, which was the first in English discussion of the anti-Sufi polemics in Safavid Iran. And her Mystics, Monarchs, and Messiahs, which I think you can see it. I have a copy of it here, actually, at home, in my view, was the second. And then with respect to this third one, I think this is the third of these seminal works. So Professor Babalyan, welcome. Thank you so very, very much. And off you go. You have the floor, metaphorically.
Thank you, Andrew, for the invitation and for really this kind introduction. I remember indeed that our friendship went back all the way to when I was writing a dissertation and asked you for a manuscript that you had also had of Mir Lohi.
Oh,
and you so generously sent it to me. So that was the beginning of a long camaraderie and collaboration. Good evening, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for actually joining us today. I'm going to be speaking to you about my book and a little bit reflections after a year that it's come out to kind of synthesize some of the important findings that I think emerge out of the city as anthology. And here, you see the new Maidan project of the capital city of Isfahan, roughly 1590s, 92, as the beginning of the conception of this new central square, the Maidan and Naqsh-e-Jahan. And of course, there have been many studies on Safavi Isfahan, looking at both the architecture, the religious, the palatial, the built environment itself, the political economy, the patronage of the Ghulams in making this new city center, and the Jufan Armenian community of family corporations that really linked Isfahan through silk trade to the entire mercantile world as a cosmopolitan center. But my contribution to this rich historiography really is to focus on and bring to life the urban life, really, with the emergence, I think, of early modern metropolitan spaces throughout the European and Asian world. These new spaces generated new forms of urban life through urban renewal projects and the transformation of the built environment. The spectacle itself for Isfahan in particular that Natanzi writes about, a really long and actually ignored chronicle that talks about the inauguration as a spectacle of sovereignty, where Shah Abbas is the savior king. It's a moment of time, both apocalyptically, as far as the astral conjunctions are concerned, but also it comes at a foot of several natural disasters, floods, earthquakes. And so one has to really understand this new space of the Naqsh-e-Jahan and the new capital city at this moment of time. And there's for sure a lot of spectacular technologies that are employed in this inauguration, pyrotechnics of Atashbazi, fireworks, festivals of life, of lights, a whole century stimulation that's staged in this square that I think ritualizes the experience of the Maidan for generations to come. And I think this is where I see Isfahan as an actor. It's an agent that invites wonder and encounter just as it censors, whether through regulations or scrutiny. And I think this tension is what is creative here, and where the anthology, the Majmu'e, comes into play. So there are thousands of what I call household anthologies or Majmu'es produced here. I see them as produced in the domestic sphere because we will come to see more clearly. They are not what is typically understood as a Majmu'e, which are single subject anthologies, collections of, you know, insha, of composition, or collections of works on astrology or the occult. These are a mishmash and a pastiche of objects of what people read in the domestic sphere. And as you see here, there's no standardization. There are these visual verbal texts are actually very much of different sizes, you know, from 10 to 15 inches long to 6 to 8 inches wide. They fill the page in different ways. So it really shows this moment of experimentation, even with the production of these household Majmu'es. What I do in the book is to bring these verbal texts of anthologies in conversation with another phenomena that Masume Farhad has written about in her dissertation on single page paintings, the production outside of court and elite ateliers of these single page paintings that are sold in the bazaar and in other spaces, it seems like. And I chose one painter to focus on, Muhammad Qasim, who actually throughout his career, here you can see all the way to the left, he's petitioning. These are signed portraits as well. He's petitioning for a job that Masume Farhad has probably situated amongst the family of Ghulams in Mashhad itself. The governors of Ghulams, the Qarachagai Khan family households of at least two or three generations. This is a portrait in the Golestan palace in Tehran, dated 1635. But we have, you know, an earlier portrait of him that you probably are familiar with that I will bring back into conversation later on, from 1627, a portrait of Shah Abbas and his beloved, which is in the Louvre. He probably comes to Isfahan at this period of time from Tabriz, so he's himself a migrant to Isfahan. That's another phenomena that's happening. There's a lot of migration in this period of time. The crème de la crème come to actually get a job in Isfahan itself. And he's also a painter who you see, and that's at the cover of my book on the very right, what is known as the bastinade or the falake, where he also signs and dates his painting. Another phenomena I think that is very, recognizable in this period of time is a historicity that emerges in chronicling even these single page paintings. And he's one who's actually very bitter. He writes poetry himself. He's, according to the anthologists of poetry, Nasrobodi at this period of time, says he's a very good poet himself. He writes, you know, today no one recognizes my true measure. Nobody knows about my bookbindings and tapes, the shirose, just as the silkworms remembered by his silk. Only when I'm dead will they sing my praises. And I do think this, you know, trying to collect his portfolio has been really useful for me. I mean, people have focused like Sheila Cambi, Andres Abbossi, sort of more well-known painters who also worked at the court atelier. He doesn't seem to have gotten any jobs at court. And so he really works for a very different clientele, which helps me think about, you know, who was commissioning, what kinds of subjects of urban life were being commissioned at this period of time. And these two paintings on the very side, the Bastinada, which is on the cover of my book, and then this one on the very right lower side, which is titled Boys Bird Nesting. It's in the British Museum from around 1650, 1655, really shows you these two very different moments of masculine taming, a moment in time where these boys are playing this bird nest game, really chaotic, untamed, being observed on the very far right corner by an older man gazing at these youth. But here, a very different setting where Mohamed Khosem is actually training his own pupils, and I'll return to this. But what goes into this process of building refined men in this moment in time of Isfahan and the capital city. But what's interesting for me too is that he has a lot of female patrons as well. And so here we have two examples of female subjects that also appear in his portfolio. So what is the relationship? I mean, that's one of the things that I was trying to figure out in the book between these single page paintings that are very clearly dated, even the place in which they are drawn, their quick drawings, clearly very instantaneous, very different from having paints in an atelier and having sort of a collaborative project of workshop painters, versus on the right your Majmue too. And this is just an example that I think encapsulates really the conversation that's also going in between these two genres of cultural production in Safavid Iran, the talisman. On your left, a single page painting by Moin Mosavar from 1663, where he's holding a talisman. And here on the right, a manuscript that again is anonymous, which the majority of these majmues are anonymous, but one can tell their profession because what is at the forefront of what is collected is things that they use for their profession. In this case, a lot of wills, marriage contracts, rental contracts as well. So we could say, locate this owner as a judge himself. And then talismans that appear here too. Talismans are all over these majmues. So which tells you something also about the everyday beliefs in these kind of talismanic operations and tools. But he also records, you know, how one can determine if a wife will die before her husband, or if a child is a female or a male, or a talisman on the very lower left of this folio, how to lower the fever of a child. And what's remarkable also about this majmue itself is that we have a name of a female inheritor, maybe the daughter of of the owner, the Ghazi himself, referring to herself as Jahan Banu, which was very important for the argument that I was making about these household anthologies, that they're domestic objects that women also participate in, and they can inherit as well, but as well read and become sort of refined residents of Isfahan as well. And but they also tell you something about what's circulated in the city, what kinds of city practices, and what kinds, importantly, of urban knowledge is in circulation and in distribution in the city. And so here again, one can see how urban knowledge and how the city itself as an actor is, you know, constituent of this cultural production, and how this anthology, both visual and verbal, can be seen as objects that motivate each other. The city motivates these objects, the production of these objects, and vice versa. So one sees in these collection of visual and verbal texts really a variety of genres that are circulating in Isfahan itself, from friendship letters to manuals of conduct to model letters that are collected to epistolary manuals, and the writing of the city itself. The genre of the Shahr al-Shub is drawn from this medieval period and really comes to narrate the entire experience, and the erotic experience actually, of the city itself, along with these single page paintings and poetry that I will come, that I focused on one widow whose Masnavi is recorded in her family anthology. So one thing I did beyond looking at these kinds of genres that cross and connect households together, namely friendship letters and gifts as two objects that not only show you what people exchanged and how they communicated with one another, but what really connected households and networks of friendship together. But I focused on two household anthologies as exemplary of how I read these majmu'es. I use them because they were named. We have the owners on the right here, a majmu'e by Agha Hossein Khansari, a famous religious cleric, and on to the left, the Urdu Badi majmu'e of bureaucrats, where the widow's Masnavi appears also as one of the collected items in this family archive itself. So what is also, I think, remarkable that helped me, because it was really difficult to figure out as I was reading through what these things are, were these two majmu'es that had table of contents. And that's an innovation in this period of time. And I read it as there's so much urban knowledge in circulation that there was a necessity in some way to order this material and information. And so you have here on your right, Ma Hadha Fil Majmu'e, and you have actually, you know, both each of the folnames it begins here with, and the folio numbers, the verso and recto. And here, very interestingly, a whole description of the different mahalles in Istanbul itself. So really thinking about the mapping of a city of Istanbul and then the mapping of a city of Isfahan in some way idiomatically through the collection of this multiple genres of information that Hossein Khansari accumulates. And here as a cleric, he's studying Arabic. He reaches an important position, but for him to write in Persian is very important. And so he has some sample letters that he writes, or these kind of hallmark spring greetings that actually get circulated and get collected also in this Urdu body majmue of bureaucrats itself. And he, you know, writes debauches. He is very intent also to, as a form of adab and refinement, to write Persian eloquently. And so engages in this culture of Persian refinement. So to move on, because I do want to actually have some time to hear your questions, these verbal texts and majmu'ahs, I think, help understand and read the visual as well, and vice versa. So one, something that's absent in the visual forms is even present in the verbal, and vice versa. And so we see, you know, in all of these four, I've gotten sort of close-up clips. This is on the left in the bottom, the famous Mohammad Ghassem's portrait of Shah Abbas and his male youth, which is also dated to, I think, 1627, that's in the Louvre. So, you know, you have these typical images that are familiar to us from Ghazal poetry, right? So that the lover and the beloved, the exchange of wine, the ways in which beauty are described and desire are described, which you can see actually the economy, the sexual economy here, even amongst the female circle of musicians and singers, and the exchange of the gaze of this male onto these female homoerotic circle of musicians, and then, you know, between these two men, a younger and a mustached male on top as well. So these are familiar to us, but do we really understand what's happening? I mean, I think we look at these, and we have looked at these exchanges as, you know, as in some way iconic. But what we see actually in the majmu'ah is that this language of eros and beauty becomes so much part of everyday life, of ways, of a phenomenology, really, of seeing, of writing, of desiring. And so that these lens that Sufism opens up for everyday exchanges of beauty, I think, becomes so embedded in the ways in which residents came to learn how to see, how to act, and also how to write and experience. And I think it's very telling in the bottom of this bastina, the Mohammad Ghassem really specifically writes out for us his intent. And he writes here, and this is a line of poetry from Taghi ed-Din Ohadi, the famous compiler of another poetic anthology, the Arafat al-Ashirin. He dies around 1640. He is in Isfahan, but he also goes to Jahangir's court and becomes a poet laureate in Jahangir's court. It tells us also how quickly poetry is circulated from Hindustan to Isfahan as well. And it deliberately says, Eshq miguyam va migeryam zor, tifl nadanam va avval as sabr. I speak love and cry. I'm an ignorant child. That is my first lesson. And I think here we have to think about sort of multiple men who remember this childhood experience, both of the bastinada and being tamed to control their desires here. And Eshq, as the caption reads, with its erotic overtones in the circle of friends and co-workers, is literally at stake. From the very beginning, educating the root child, the root male child, entailed the taming of homoerotic desire and passion, expressed both in word and affect. And it required an etiquette of the body of adab itself, which helps us really read, I think, a lot of these visuals in very different ways, or in ways in which we can think beyond just representation, but actually experience and performance too. And these statements about, you know, childhood taming, you see it all over. Molla Sadra, for instance, has it. Mohsen Efes talks about this remembering a very clear boyhood memory, whether it's a memory that they've experienced themselves, or whether it's part of that masculine performance of having a had to regulate and tame in this way, be a refined male subject in this context of urbanity. So gifts, as I said, are another form that are exchanged in addition to letters amongst painters, but also across these household anthologies. And whereas, you know, this iconic representation of male youth were commonplace drawings that circulated in Isfahan on sheets of paper, some were personalized. On the margin of this portrait of a male youth, Moin Musabbar writes that it was executed on Friday, the 20th of the holy month of Ramadan in the year 1047, on the 5th of February, 1638. Along with the date, the painter records that this watercolor was painted in the blessed home, Dolatkhane, of my dearest Shafia Azize. Moin adds his signature to the portrait of his friend's beloved, drawn, he writes, by Moino Ragamahu. He paints Shafiha's beloved in his home on the penultimate Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan. Calling attention to the viewer's gaze, the beloved's facial hair, his arrow-shaped eyebrows, and the distant look in his eyes, he highlights the verbal and visual topoi of beauty of the beloved. Here on this page, the beloved is realized, historicized, and identified. We know that friends often visited each other as home, and lots of them, you know, on a Friday, they write, and a lot of the paintings which Masume Farhad has looked at happen, these quick paintings, on Fridays when people are socializing at their friend's home. But from the letters that I've also been able to read in these majmues, there's lots of, you know, in letters inviting friends for morning coffee or for specialty foods like sheep trotters, kale poche, or soup, osh, and the vegetable frittata kuku for lunch. In this case, Moin Musabbar and Shafia were probably waiting for the sun to set so that they could break their fast together. Composed to mark an intimate occasion, these singular paintings collected in household anthologies preserve a gradual turn to naturalism. Together with the friendship letters that circulated in and out of Isfahan, such drawings archive everyday life. Moin's drawing of Shafia's beloved tells us something also about passing time on empty stomachs, appreciating the beauty of a male youth, even on Friday during the holy month of Ramadan. The beauty of the male beloved, moreover, was to be recognized and desired in masculine adab as a signifier of the city of Isfahan itself. So beauty, the way in which the beauty of the male beloved, which is again going into part of the Sufi phenomenology, also came to be translated onto the experience of Isfahan. During his travels in Hindustan, Nasiro Hamedani, who's probably writing this letter in 1610, to his famous friend in Isfahan, Ali Reza Abbasi, the painter, Nasiro asks his friend to send him, I'm quoting, a life-giving human image as a memento of Isfahan's beauty to gratify his longing and erotic desire. He names it Havas. The request for a portrait, a surat, of a male Isfahani beauty was part of the adab of masculinity, which connected Ali Reza Abbasi to Nasiro and his acquaintances in Mughal India. This gift of friendship had the power to forge bonds as men viewed and communicated the adab of aesthetics and erotics beyond imperial dominions. Even as Nasiro was boasting about his friendship with the celebrated painter, it was the exchange and the subject of the gift that mattered. He says, "Let me, Nasiro, show them," the Mughal Indians that he's in contact with, "how your," Ali Reza Abbasi's painting, "encapsulates the beauty of Esfahan." The homoerotic vista household anthologies expose bring into sharp focus the materiality of Esfahan with a view onto how the city was affectively seen, read, written, and desired. Nasiro's letter to Ali Reza Abbasi circulated widely, prized for its value as an exemplary object of adab and written in eloquent poetry and prose. The letter quickly became a classic model to emulate and to read in households and friendship circles. Yet Nasiro's letter also encapsulates what I've been talking about, this phenomenology of experience shared in Esfahan's household. As he lays out the work that portraits performs, he draws on the mystical vocabulary of transcendence to write his yearning for Esfahan's beauty in a language that merges sexual desire with spirituality. Nasiro evokes Shah Abbas's ideal city, analogized to the Naqsh-e-Jahan, the image of the world, which today remains a metonym for Esfahan. But the intimate connections between urbanity, eroticism, friendship, and spirituality operative in the 17th century has been lost to the significance of the central square. Thousands of friendship letters assembled in anthologies sit in Tehran's manuscript libraries, and thousands of portraits of male youth are housed in museums worldwide. Their bond and affinity have been severed by our modern taxonomies and habits of collecting. So the city of anthology has reunited the visual with the verbal to make the city familiar and provide a new and enticing, I hope, panorama of what it means to experience early modern Esfahan. Thank you.
That's absolutely terrific. Thank you very, very much, Catherine. So I have questions so far, and I will take them in the order I have them. The first question I saw was, my question is, if in the city of Esfahan these writings or majmues or letters were used in daily life, or were they a way of only a way of bureaucratic communication?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So, you know, in the anthology of the bureaucratic household of the Urdu bodies, what is collected is what the grandfather, who was also working at court in the chancery, what he wrote. And so that would help also the further, you know, the contemporaneous generation in the art and craft of writing diplomatic letters. But these letters that are collected in other household anthologies are not diplomatic at all. They are daily letters, as I say, inviting somebody to have kalupoche with them for lunch, a friend. They are both model letters. So the letter Nasiro wrote to Ali Reza Abbasi become letters of how to, you know, collect it as model letters, beautifully written letters, but also the subject matter. I mean, one has to think about, yes, they are, you know, they are models. They're models that are emulated. And of course, then this is the generative part of these letters. Then they also create different kinds of subjectivities where the individual in the household who's collected them will write their own composition and their own piece. So I think that they are letters that are for sure tell you something about, you know, how friends wrote to one another, what subjects they wrote about for one another, but in the sense that they also motivate, you know, their own letter writing as a, they're not formulaic in that sense, even though we do have manuals of model letters, but yes, they would be used for everyday life. They're used to write to friends and relatives outside of Isfahan. I think it's very important when we're thinking about this performance of Isfahan. It's also part of writing the cities, not only those people who are living in the city, those people who actually want to travel to the city, right? So want to learn about how to be refined when you travel, kind of like the beginnings of a travelogue, really. But one has to really pursue also, I think, you know, anthologies from other parts collected in other cities like Qazvin. There's a lot of anthologies that are also produced in Qazvin and in Ray, for instance, to see, you know, what is collected there versus what is collected in Isfahan. I limited my collecting of anthologies and studying of anthologies to Isfahan of the 17th century. So there's a lot more that needs to be done.
Yeah. This intersects into the next question that I have. How many of these collections did you examine? Where are they now held, in private collections or libraries of institutions? If the latter, how were they collected?
Mm-hmm. Great question. So there are thousands, as I say, and a colleague of mine in the University of Tehran, Nozhat Ahmadiyya, and myself are collaborating on sort of compiling these anthologies and digitizing them and hopefully making them available to everyone. It's you know, a project which will take a long time, but it's just it's at its beginning moment. The ones that I use, so the most obvious ones, are in Malik Library, in the Tehran University Library, and in the Majlis University Library. There are also collections in Isfahan as well, which have not been cataloged. So that's one of the things that we're working on. There are anthologies all over the world, from European museums and libraries to the University of Michigan, that has actually 19 anthologies from the 17th and 18th centuries. So how were they received? So I think that that's a very important reason why I chose the Urdu Bodi and the Khansari Majmuas, because I think that what happens is that the entire library of the Khansaris and of the Urdu bodies are kept in more or less intact, and then are donated at some period of time. And that provenance is something that one has to, I have to look into. I don't know if there's that kind of information. Agha Hossein Khansari's majmuah, there are four or five of them, each of them are different majmuahs, are in the Tehran University Library. And Tehran University Library, once it was established in the 1930s, received a lot of these gifts and donations from private households. But one thing that also happens is that, you know, these are inherited, they're sold. And of course, some of them are, a lot of them have been lost that way. So, but there is a whole history, which I'm going to, is going to be, you know, the next project is a history of reading, because you can actually see print comes in late in Iran. And so these anthologies keep circulating through different ownerships, have different seals, prices of purchase even, and then marginalia. So one can really get at this history of reading, I think, by sort of following through, journeying through the different travels and hands of ownership of these majmuas.
At the risk of sounding old, I mean, I am old, but when I first got interested in this field, it used to be said that all this kind of material, anything that would be sort of local material, was all burned by the Afghans when they came in. And that's why there was a dearth of all this kind of material. And I can't remember the footnote to that, obviously, but that's the sort of conventional wisdom that I just...
That was the story I was educated into.
Completely off the mark. But clearly that's not the case, I guess, is what I wanted to say. And so this is absolutely terrific, and all... best wishes to the two of you and anybody else who's involved in kind of getting this material, preserving it and notifying it, so that we can all use it. I have a couple more questions. Hold on here. I want to make sure I get these in order. Right. Thank you for the nice paintings. Shafia and Moene are female names, not male. Is this my misunderstanding, or are you trying to show a kind of homosexuality here?
No, they're not female names at all. Shafia and Muina are both Mu'in, And that his signature is Moinah. That's how he signs. We know the painter Moin Mossafar and Shafi. So Shafio. These are terms that are used, and you see actually the name here very clearly written on the left margins. No, these are males, and homosexuality is not a term that is viable for the pre-modern period, and that's why I use homoeroticism. And so the practices are different before these typologies and categorizations that come into play in the 19th centuries.
Another question. In the slide of Urdu Body, can you tell us more about the content? There are so many squares. Is it like a journal?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, these are table of contents. So different ways of writing out. As I said, it's a very sort of original addition to anthologies and manuscripts here. So, you know, here you have a list. And I think it is interesting to see that you have a list, of course, with what is common, what you see in these types of organizing material. And here you have squares, right? And what you also have is a different pagination. So what happens with this anthology is that it grows. It is cut apart, and there are additions as it moves from Isfahan, probably after the Afghan invasion, to Ordubad itself. There is a continuation of the family histories. So you have letters. You have, Agha Hossein Khansari's debauches there. You have Nasira's letters as well, Nasira Hamedani's letters. You have a lot, another figure who appears, a literati, Zuhuri's letters and debauches that appear. You have Saib's letters, and you have that Masnavi. You also have examples of the family poetry, ghazals, ghasides. So there's really a mixture, letters, model letters asking for wine, or asking what appears also very commonly, a request for eyeglasses, einach, or for yogurt. So it is a mishmash of both what comes in the beginning, which are these diplomatic correspondences where we can actually really locate, even though we know the name of the owners and the family members who worked at the Safavid court in the 17th century too, but what was professionally used. And then in addition, what was also collected in this household, probably collected on loose sleeves and at some point the scribe, and we know the name of the scribe for Agha Hossein Khansari. He names himself as Reza Qoli in the bottom here. I don't know if you get to see it. We actually have the dates of both the beginning, Shuru, and Itmam, Khatime, a three-year period of time, which gives us a sense really of the process of compiling. And, in this case with the scribe Reza Qoli, he makes certain that he knows when is the handwriting. So we have actually three hands here. When is the handwriting of Agha Hossein Khansari in the majmua itself? Where has he actually gone to find a copy of a certain essay on the taqvim, for instance, on the calendar, that he knows nothing about? And he says, well, I copied it verbatim. So you get a sense that this is also, these are, not urban knowledge in circulation, not only in the household, but he actually goes out, finds it, locates it, records it, and then it becomes part of this assemblage, which is, Hossein Khansari's majmua.
Right, another question. I get that the letters are a way of understanding the topics of the day. However, I'm a bit skeptical about treating paintings as representative of everyday lifestyle. Who painted? For what purpose did they paint is maybe my question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the painting itself of Moin tells you with its inscription, so something that art historians have worked on very carefully from Sheila Cambi to Masume Farhad and now Keshvar Rizvi as well, that, you know, these single page paintings, when you have, they come inscribed. They come inscribed with the dates. They identify the house as we saw here, the Dolat Khane of Shafiur itself, the moment in time when this painting of Shafiur's beloved was materialized. And so, of course, it's about day-to-day life. I mean, the most obvious of works is Moin Mosavar's work that Masume Farhad has written about, is the lion that escapes in the city of Esfahan, where Moin says, I didn't see it, but the rumors have circulated. And what was really dramatic about this was that this lion actually ate and killed a young boy who was an apprentice. And so there is marginalia where Moin Mosavar describes in detail this event and how it rocked the residents of Esfahan. And it comes at a point where he's also talking about, we had snow in the spring, we had snow and it was cold and everything was iced. And so, yes, this is not a representation that is completely an imaginary. Yeah, it is very much chronicling life and these intimate moments, or these very dramatic moments with the lion eating the young apprentice.
Another question. Clearly, these works are going to be very important for social and economic history of Isfahan and other cities. Thank you for initiating this important study, which will have many developments in the future. Not exactly a question, but I wonder if you could kind of speak to the what you have seen and maybe not looked at so intensely in that way, but you think that what you have seen offers this possibility here?
Totally. I mean, I'm hoping that my work is a social history, that is really something that I see as coming out of this book. But economic history is an important element. You're absolutely right that, you know, we've relied on the Dutch archives. Rudy has worked on the Dutch archives and Cebu Aslanian on the Jufan letters of exchange. And we have not that much information till now on the economy, the local economy, and it is there. So, I mean, you have wills, and that's another way of thinking about inheritance and the circulation of goods. But we also have records also of, exchanges, the selling price of different jewels, the market prices also of different sort of luxury items are the ones that I've seen more. And I think that there's so much there that I haven't seen. So I think going back to the question, which I didn't answer, is like, how many of these have you seen? I mean, I have really looked and read carefully through at least 300, but at least 500 of these majmuas, I've gone through the table of contents and flipped through the folios. So there's a lot more, absolutely. And I think that that kind of information is there.
Okay, thank you. Another comment, question, yes, as well. Thank you, Professor Balbayon, for a fascinating presentation and study. With your usual perceptive gaze and using sources that have been hitherto unused, you bring to life a wealth of information about urban life in Safavid Isfahan. Quick query, these represent the life of the haves, not the general public, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and that's another, it's a good question. It's about, who has access to painting and to writing, right? And so that opens up this very broad and important question of literacy, right? And I think that there, together with my colleagues, Paul Lazinski, for instance, who talks about the circulation of poetry and really in some way the democratization of poetry in this period of time, that one can get out of an anthology like that of the Nasrobodi, where he talks about all people from all walks of life who leave their father's profession laundromat and take up poetry. And so that one sees a diffusion for sure of, you know, different levels of literacy. So also in these manuals of writing letters, one even there gets a sense not only of gendered addresses and addressees, but also of different levels of literacy, so that there is a preemption for those who don't necessarily have khat and who can't write these elaborate letters, to basically just write the opening of what we see in the Ghazal. And that's a whole interesting phenomenon of how the Ghazal is transformed into these prose letters in this period of time. Just the opening line of greetings, and then, you know, half a seal can appear. And so I think, you know, that from these majmuas we see a wide also spectrum of literacy. But something that I argue is also that the city itself and the center square, there's painting all over, there are colors all over, there is calligraphy all over, right? And this is part of this cultivation of aesthetics that is available for, I think, a wide variety of residents, and also perhaps what gives incentive and incites the desire to learn poetry and to write poetry, to actually commission a painting that is, you know, a very quick drawing that is obviously cheaper to purchase. And so we have to also think about a larger middle class here. And so there's definitely a lot of wills that come from Haji Muhammad, for instance, that are recorded, so that, you know, with the flourishing of the economy, that we have the ability, and that's why we have more of these single page paintings, I think, and the majmuas, is that there's an ability, paper is produced in Isfahan too, there is more accessibility, and the power of purchase to enter into this economy.
Okay, thank you very much. I've got a couple questions, and then I have a question from Facebook as well, but I'll do the ones in which I have in the Q&A. Are there actually any direct connections between the texts and the paintings? For example, the artists, Muhammad Qasim or anyone else, or their works being referred to in the letters, such as buying a picture, for example, commissioning a portrait?
Yes, great. Definitely. I mean, so the example I gave you of Nasire Hamedani, which becomes really a classic in many of these anthologies, the way to think about what gets, you know, what gets collected more popularly, is an example of him asking his friend Alirza Abbasi. There are more examples of, you know, commissioning paintings by certain painters. Saeb, for instance, is really also very prevalent. The poet laureate is very prevalent in these majmuas. But I think that one has to really also think about, and that's why I gave that example of the talisman. So what connects, when, you know, what connects the visual with the verbal are certain kinds of practices like divination and the occult. But I think gift giving is one of them. And I think letters are definitely one that are, you know, circulated and are picked up on in these circles of friends, and that's where they, you know, they're recorded, and then they become sort of more popular compositions also as models. But definitely there are collections as far as sort of the motivating aspects of what gets represented and painted and depicted in paintings and in you know, adab, in verbal adab. And I think part of that is like these people who are coming from all over the Iranian world, but they're also, you know, coming from India as well, as far as merchants. How do they communicate with one another? What, you know, how do you speak to one another? What kind of gestures do you embody to be considered to be, you know, a refined urban subject? And in that sense, the visual and the verbal also teach, they're didactic, but they also allow one to perform, I think, urbanity.
The bouncing off of the point you made about India, there's a question from Facebook about the visibility of this culture in Mughal India as well.
Totally. I mean, I think that the example that I gave of Tajuddin Ohadi at Jahangir's court and his poetry really circulating, something that you see, and I've looked at some of these anthologies that travel actually to Bengal, for instance. So Zohuri, Nasiroy Hamedani, these are all literati who write compositions of, you know, how to write a deboche, for instance, or how to write a letter that circulate and actually create this adab of Persianate culture across imperial frontiers.
Okay, I've got a couple more questions. Given the often homoerotic content, the Majmuays in Tehran City University, I hope I've got this right. The Majmuays in Tehran City University actually used, I guess, are the Majmuays in Tehran City University actually used in current teaching in Iran, or are they available to students in Tehran?
They are, you know, thanks to Jafarian, Rasul Jafarian, who's right now the director of the Tehran University Library. He has digitalized most of the manuscripts. They're available, they're used. You can purchase them. It's more difficult, but at some point you could download them. He did the same for the Majlis Library. It's really his vision to actually make these manuscripts available not only to, you know, Iranians, but really to us as well outside of Iran.
All right. One comment, fascinating presentation. Thank you. Another question is that, is the city of Isfahan an object of erotic desire?
Mm-hmm. Yes, totally. Because what I try to develop in my talk and in the book is to show, first of all, you know, how is beauty appreciated? How is beauty experienced? And one has to understand the experiencing of beauty through Sufi lenses. And we've, you know, talked about Paul Lizinski, for instance, has talked about how in this Maktab-e Vughui of Ghazals, this metaphysical experience of the divine, that it's always mediated through a male object of desire, beautiful object of desire, comes to earth in this period of time, right? So the real people, real lovers and beloveds who are named and the places in which they're encountered. I mean, Walter Andrews and Mehmet Kapakli have done the same for Istanbul in this period of time. But what I'm adding to that is that actually this this phenomena of how to see and appreciate beauty is also then part of the ways in which residents are educated in experiencing and seeing the beauty of Isfahan. And it's this erotic lens of seeing and writing and experiencing that I think has been lost to us in that we talk about the Naqsh-e-Jahan and we talk about, you know, Isfahan, Nisf-e-Jahan, but what does it mean? I mean, we step into this incredible Maidan and we think we experience it in the same way as people experienced it 500 years before. And I think as good historians, we have to say, no, there was a difference. And this is part, I think, of the difference.
Okay, I'll take one or two more questions, which I haven't got up yet because we're kind of coming to the end of our time. We started a bit late, but if I could have the privilege of the I'm not sure I'm the chair, but the MC, lots of things I wanted to ask, some of which were answered. I wanted to talk more about the Shahrashu, but the one that you've got, the Khonsari, is interesting because, of course, you know the, if you will, the writing side of Khonsari as well. Exactly. And I wonder the extent to which his Majmuay opens up new aspects of his personality and ideas versus what we've looked at him in terms of his more, you know, his being a cleric and a great thinker.
No, that's a great question. And that's something I take up in the chapter when I work on Khonsari. What's interesting is that as a public figure, That's exactly what we have. We have the books that he has written and that are circulating. We have his anti-Sufi rads, right? We have his works against drinking of wine, his fatwas against drinking of wine. But then, you know, when we look at what is collected within the household, it starts off with this whole series of books on divination, of fol nomes, right? So there we get a sense of, you know, what he was practicing also outside of what gets published as far as his own work is concerned. And so fol nomes of Imam Ali, of Ja'far al-Sadiq, of sort of linking and lines of the Quran to then, you know, everyday activities in Persian, right, which he probably used as a notebook to learn. And then you see this interest in prose and poetry, and in him himself really refining and experiencing and putting himself out there as somebody who writes beautiful in Persian. And then we have Vahshi's Khosrow and Shirin, where we see that he has a taste also for, you know, somebody who's just died maybe 50 years before, who gets picked up on in Agha Hossein Khansouri's, you know, taste for poetry. And then, you know, there's connections there too. So to go back to the other question about, you know, the painters and then these collectors of anthology. So, you know, Vahshi is depicted probably in Mashhad at the court of Qarajdai Khan, is depicted, does Muhammad Qasim does depict and illustrate the manuscript of Vahshi as well. So you see sort of points of similar cultural interests that circulate amongst both these verbal and visual. But to go back to your question, Andrew, yes, you see a very different side that we would have never, you know, imagined if we had just taken his oeuvre of what was sort of quote unquote published in his for his religious text.
One more question here. Were any sections of these notebooks ever copied and recopied for wider circulation or sale, mm-hmm. or even inspired later works in the genre, for example, in the form of later kashkuls or jongs?
Uh-huh. Yeah, so, you know, that's the question that really needs to be pursued through this digitalization and comparing. I mean, you know, one term that appears is bayaz. And so Bayaz, so it seems like there are copies of, let's say, Hamadani or Zuhuri's debauches or Agha Hossein Khansouri's debauches. So there's definitely a whole technical variety of terms that I've also tried to at least get at with the Urdu body Majmue and the Hossein Khansouri Majmue, where does the scribe, how does the scribe depict Roqe versus a bayaz, right? And so when do these technical terms get used to talk about a particular kind of recording from the authentic source or not, or as a copy, or a copy of a copy itself? But, you know, that's a great question, which really needs to be pursued in the future.
And then the final question I would ask is, so have you all, working with colleagues in Iran, got a work plan here?
Do have a work plan. We've already cataloged the Meli Library Majmues, which was not cataloged. And so now, you know, Nosal Ahmadi is working on the Esfahan Library catalog as well. I'm in the process of applying for grants, because these are, you know, huge projects, to be able to actually Yeah, to be able to have enough money to send to Iran. And then, of course, with the sanctions, you know, there's a whole other issue going on there. And this summer, I'm going to begin the digitalizing collection of European libraries of Majmuas there, so that we'll sort of cover those fronts. But I'm hoping that this is a project that I have some seed money for, that I will be able to get a bigger grant for, and that we will then, you know, pursue very quietly the Tehran University Library.
Yeah, this may be a bit tricky. We had a large number of attendees today. So, but in any case, I think this is absolutely great. I'm so glad, Catherine. It's very, very nice to see you again. And it's terrific to hear about this book. And not only the book itself, but the prompt, but the sources, the ways of being thinking about it. And I think this is right. It opens up a whole new variety of material that can be consulted to tell us much more, I think, about what's going on the ground, as it were, in Isfahan and the other cities and in the country as a whole, from the lips or the hands of the people who are actually there, which I think is absolutely terrific. And a lot more compliments here of what a great talk, so informing. Thank you so very much. I'll let you go, and thank you very much to everyone who asked questions, to everyone who was there, and this is absolutely brilliant. Make sure that you, when you're making progress in this, send it out, and I will most certainly see that it is circulated so that we can keep track of this.
Okay. Thank you so much for the invitation, Andrew, and for all of you for this rich engagement. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Terrific. And thank you all for attendees, and also to Sylvia and Imogen and the BIPS office for the all sorts of technical assistance and all. And with that, I will shut down. This should be mounted on the BIPS site if people want to look at it. Again, more messages of congratulations and thanks as well. And with that, from a sunny Edinburgh, I say, unusual. I say good evening and thank you again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.